When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Previously on Electric Boogaloo.
Are you suggesting, Dr. Webster,
yeah,
that Khal Drogo is a secret Targaryen?
Either that or Blackfyre. I'm not sure which.
Welcome to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I am your host, Anthony. Today we'll be talking about Chapter 4 with Dr. Chad Carmichael. Chad is a philosopher and an old friend, and I always have an enormous amount of fun talking with Chad about almost anything, but specifically Game of Thrones. We'll check in with Steve as he's done his first watch of Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things. If you're interested in anything going on at Bald Move, check out baldmove.com. I recommend the club. If you're interested in sending feedback, you can send that to book@baldmove.com. Please rate and review this podcast if you haven't done so already, and tell a friend. Who knows? Maybe if we can keep our numbers up, we can keep this podcast rolling past Chapter 9. Without further ado, here is Dr. Chad Carmichael. Chad Carmichael, welcome to this podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Are you nervous?
No.
You're not nervous.
It's not live.
That's true. We can always edit anything out though. It's unsavory.
That's right. Yeah. So it doesn't make me nervous. It feels like two old friends having a talk about something we've talked about 100 times before.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said that because this is a chapter about two old friends.
Yeah.
Chad.
Yes.
Shall we talk about our voices?
Sure.
What is your relationship to your own voice?
My relationship to my voice, I guess. Well, I'm a teacher. I teach philosophy, and so I do a lot of lecturing. I guess I haven't thought very much about my voice, although I guess I've had to confront my voice a little bit more directly in the last week or two as we've been having to record lectures and interact with students online more. And so I end up hearing myself more often in recorded form.
And what is your sense of it as you hear it?
I don't know. I guess I don't have much. I guess I think I have a fairly normal voice. I hope that's true.
You know what? You do have a normal voice, so I don't know if that's a compliment or whatever, but you're one of the, you know what? I think your voice matches your physique. You're one of these few people who you just look like a normal guy and you just have a normal voice.
Well, there you go. I'm happy with that.
Which makes you somewhat unique.
I've always wanted for things like my voice or how I dress or what I look like or that sort of thing. I've always wanted that to sort of fade into the background. I've always wanted, as a human being, for people to find my ideas interesting, not because of my degree or the way that I look or the way that I present myself, but just because the ideas themselves are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always sort of aspired to that.
Aspired to superficial normalcy.
Yeah, I mean, on the stuff that's superficial and normal, superficial and unimportant.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I get it. All right. So we're covering Chapter 4 of A Game of Thrones, and this is Eddard Stark's first POV chapter. And so, Chad, I'm just going to go ahead and I'll do a quick synopsis of this chapter, and whatever I've left out, we can fill in our conversation.
Okay,
so here's my synopsis. The King's Party arrives at Winterfell, and this means that Baratheons and Lannisters are flooding the walls of Winterfell. And after some notable key character introductions, there's the true reunion between Ned and Robert. and Robert asks to show his respects to Lyanna. They go down to the crypts of Winterfell, and they have this long conversation. And as they meander through the crypts, they visit her grave, and their conversation kind of is a tour of the Seven Kingdoms and the distant past and the more recent past. So we get to hear about the death of Ned's father and brother and the battle at the Trident and John Arryn's mysterious death. And then finally, Robert asks Ned to take over as Hand of the King. Ned says he's honored and politely asked to think it over. And in many ways, it's a very uneventful chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways. And in other ways, it plants a lot of really important seeds. And it's a chapter that people will come back and read again.
Right. So I think that they're laying a lot of track here. So yeah. I think maybe on first read, and I don't remember my first read of this chapter very well, but I think on first read, it's like, man, there's a lot of people and places that are being introduced here, and I don't really know what to do with all of this.
Yeah, but I think when I read it the very first time, I think he does a good job of hinting at certain mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
You're so unclear at this stage. I mean, this is chapter 4 of this very, very long tale. And you're so unclear at this stage what the heck is going on that you don't even really know what questions to ask. And so I think I found for me, like, a lot of it just kind of washed over me and I didn't even know what mattered or what didn't matter the first time I read it. It's for that reason, I think, later on when you start to get drawn further into some of these mysteries, you end up coming back and reading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. And I think that especially the question of John's parentage, when that becomes a key plot point,
yeah,
I think that once the reader is convinced of the, you know, this fan theory that in reality, John's true mother and father are different than what we had expected.
Right.
I think that this may be the chapter that they come back to. And okay, first, here it is. The first seeds of this particular mystery are here in this chapter. And specifically because Ned and Robert are talking about why Lyanna is buried here in these cold crypts. And Robert would rather have her buried high on a hill with the rain to wash her clean under a fruit tree, right, and all of that business.
Well, so, Robert shows up and he's got a lot of ideas about what Ned should be doing, how Ned should be addressing him, mm-hmm. where Ned should be living, where Ned should have buried his sister. What, you know, a lot of things. I get this picture of Robert kind of messing up Ned's hair and giving him a noogie, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's part of their relationship. And in the midst of that conversation, Ned says she's here because she's of the North and I was with her when she died. And Ned's thinking back to her deathbed.
Yeah.
And she says, promise me. Then, you know, it's kind of vague. You would think by the context, what she's talking about is, promise me that you'll bury me in the crypts of Winterfell. Yeah. But in retrospect, we're looking back and we're thinking, promise me. Oh, this is the first glimpse of this conversation where Ned has made this promise to his sister that will really sort of unfold one of these key plot points.
And the promise we come to believe is to raise Jon Snow as his own son.
And lie about it. Lie about his true parentage, because that would put Jon in mortal peril, you know?
Right.
Okay, so we've rounded into this relationship between Ned and Robert, right?
Yeah.
So you think that this is a head-tussling relationship?
Yeah. I mean, it says early in the chapter that it said something like Ned loved Robert for wanting to pay respects first thing when he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get a sense that Ned cares for Robert. You get the sense that he's troubled, too, because Robert's put on like 100 pounds.
And,
you know, he looks like a drunk and stuff like this. But there is some underlying love there. And these guys have been through a lot together, though they haven't seen each other for a long time, right? But yeah, I'm struck at the way that Ned is very kind of accommodating to Robert. He treats him like a king.
Uh-huh.
But Robert treats Ned like a little brother.
Ned keeps on calling him Your Grace, and showing him every courtesy of a king.
That's right.
And Robert's kind of not having it.
Right. I mean, by the end, he literally says, quit calling me Your Grace.
You know, right.
We're closer than that. You don't need to call me that.
All right. We're going to do the guest choice portion of the podcast.
Okay.
Which means you can choose a character, you can choose a plot point, a theme, or we can just climb the ladder of chaos, which means we just kind of see where the conversation goes.
I'm choosing chaos.
You're choosing chaos.
Chaos.
This is not in keeping with your personality.
Yeah, well, I read the chapter again last night. I jotted down a few things that I thought were interesting, and I just want to talk about all of it.
Okay, good. Let's talk more about, if you don't mind, since you brought it up previously, this relationship between Ned and Robert. Okay.
Incidentally, it's a little unclear to me why Ned is supposed to be short for Eddard.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's like a Margaret Peggy sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess.
How do we get Peggy from Margaret?
Yeah, there's a number of names like that, I guess. Yeah,
sure. Sure. All right. Here's what I was thinking. I was rereading this last night and I was thinking, I think the obvious observation to make here is that you interact with friends differently when you're 20 than when you're 35. I think that these two have lived a much different life in the span of the years between the Trident and the current age. So age just brings out a different aspects of different characters.
Sure.
However, I think that there's something else that's interesting about these two, and I want to get your take on this. I would imagine that there is a difference between a wartime comrade and that same comrade in peace several years later. So I think that it's not just a difference between being in your 20s and being in your 30s. There's also a difference of being a comrade in arms versus being sort of political allies in peace. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I've never served in a war. I haven't been a soldier, but I imagine that there's a kind of bonding that happens when you are together facing an immediate physical threat and depending on one another in all sorts of different ways for your safety. I think there's got to be a special bond that happens in that moment. And I would imagine that when the moment has passed and you're safe again, that what bonds you at a later date is not obviously going to be an immediate threat when you're safe once again. It's going to be the memory of the things that you went through. And I suppose that ideally friends, of course, old friends will have memories together that do bond them. And I think that's a precious thing. But I think ideally your friendship goes on into the present where present concerns and present needs and present considerations play some role in bringing you together.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see between these two guys is that they have a lot of good memories of being bonded, but present considerations are hard on their relationship.
Okay. In addition to that, I mean, yes, absolutely. I think that we're talking about something like the intimacy of war.
Yeah. Sure. I think the closest thing that I have to rely on in my own experience is the incredible feelings of gratefulness that I had toward the nurses that attended my wife when she was giving birth. Especially, you know, when my first was born and my wife had a troubled labor and there was some danger medically, just the feeling of helplessness and the gratefulness that you feel toward a person who is there to help you and knows what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know these women who attended my wife. I didn't know them the day before, but the day of, I felt so grateful to them and so bonded to them.
Yeah, they're the most important people in the world at that moment.
Yeah, and yeah. So you know, even if I saw them now, they would have a special place in my heart, even though it's been 16 years since that day.
That's interesting.
But in a friendship, you want the life of the friendship to be developing in real time as you move forward together. You know, you don't want it all to be in the past.
Okay, so back to Robert and Ned.
Yeah.
So I think that Robert really looks fondly upon his sort of glory days, right?
Yeah.
And
I sort of imagine a sort of heavy metal god, you know, I imagine like a 1980s, you know, the flowing hair and the rippling muscles.
He's Jim Morrison is.
Yeah,
what
definitely. Yeah. Something like maybe like an even more muscle bound version. He's like, I don't know. Yeah. Vince Neil or something.
Okay. So he's Vince Neil. All right. So Robert's looking back on the glory days, and things were simpler back then. And he's kind of a simple guy. You give him a party and with all of the elements of a good party, and Robert's happy. Ned is not quite that way. And I think that if we read a little bit further, we find out that really Robert, not only does Robert long for the glory days of when he won the throne, he kind of sees a war on the horizon. And he's part of the reason that he wants Ned to serve as Hand of the King is that he knows that there is going to be some sort of war upcoming.
Yeah.
And Ned is the opposite. Ned is, I think, a man of peace. He wants to keep the peace up north, and that's his mission. That's his whole life mission. He's going to do well by the people in the north and keep the peace as well as he can. And this is going to put these two at odds, I think.
Yeah, that might be right. I don't know if I agree with what you said about Robert's. It sounds much more reasonable than I take Robert to be. I mean, he's clearly concerned a little bit about war. He does mention that when he says that he's not naming the child as the Lord of the Eyrie.
Yeah.
Ned is kind of surprised, and he says something like, well, you know, he can't lead in a war.
Right. So yeah, Robert Arryn is six and sickly, and he's not going to be able to hold the East in a war, right? So he's not going to be Warden of the East.
So Ned
replies by saying, look, the title is honorary in peacetime. What are we talking about here?
Right. So clearly you're right that Robert has some concern about war, but I mean, he explicitly says his reason for wanting Ned to be the Hand, and that's so that he can get back to drinking and whoring.
Well, he says, I want you to run my kingdom and fight my wars.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
So in other words, while I drink and wench myself to an early death.
that's the part I remembered.
So that's when I say he's kind of a simple man. That's what I mean by that.
Yeah.
But I think that there's something about being a soldier where, you don't have all of these other complexities kind of maybe fade while you're focused on just surviving and winning the next objective or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's not very. It made me think that Robert is not a good friend. I mean, he doesn't like this job.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
He knows that Ned wants to stay where he is.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, he's going to bring Ned this frozen man of the north. He's going to bring him down south where it's hot and crowded, and he's going to make him the Hand, which. According to Robert, means that he gets to eat and Ned has to do the dirty business, right? That's a sort of the...
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When I read that, I thought, would I do this to my friend? Would I call upon my friend to do such a burdensome job that I do not want to do?
Okay. So Chad Carmichael.
Yeah.
You are a philosopher.
Yes.
And this conversation recalls to me Aristotle's three levels of friendship.
Okay. Right. I don't know that much about Aristotle.
Okay. All right. No, well, if you're a professional thinker, so let me recount what I think I remember about these three levels of friendship.
Yeah.
For Aristotle. Okay. So first level of friendship is the friendship of utility. And what Aristotle says about the friendship of utility is that it's not bad. It's just the friendship that you would have with like the butcher. You know, you walk down to the market, you order your meat, you have a pleasant relationship. It serves you to have a pleasant relationship with the butcher. And I shouldn't use pleasant because that's the next level, but it serves you to have a good working relationship.
Yeah.
With the butcher. Same thing with courtesy. I think modern folks, like if you had a roommate, it serves a good purpose to have a good relationship with your roommate. You don't have to be best friends, but eventually you're going to want the bills paid and you don't want to feel weird living in your own house.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think Aristotle would call that a friendship of utility. Next level is what Aristotle would call the friendship of pleasantness or pleasure. And this is simply like, if you're at a party, who's going to make you laugh the most? Who's going to make you feel better about yourself and make you, you just feel better, feel good? It just feels good to be around that person. Mm-hmm. And I think most like online relationships are friendships of pleasure. Like if someone doesn't make you feel good on Facebook, you unfriend them or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the highest level of friendship for Aristotle is this friendship of mutual virtue, mm-hmm. where you want the best for the other person. In fact, you want your personage to bring the best virtue out of the other person. And you want that person, it's sort of like iron sharpening iron. Like we are better people mm-hmm. because we are friends. You make me a better person, I make you a better person. My feeling, well, let me ask you, given those three stages, utility, pleasantness, and virtue, what level of friendship do these two men have?
Yeah, I think they definitely don't seem to me to be enjoying each other.
I disagree. Okay, well, but keep going.
Let's take it one at a time. Ned's not enjoying Robert. He's finding Robert troubling and troubled. He is concerned about what Robert's going to be asking him to do.
Yeah, yeah.
He's all that continually, continually shocked by the decisions Robert has made. Plans that Robert has are troubling to Ned. I don't find that Ned is enjoying Robert. Is Robert enjoying Ned? I mean, I feel like he's sort of through the scene. He's trying to enjoy Ned. He's hugging him. He's kind of trying to draw some emotion out of him. He's continually frustrated at Ned's kind of frozen face. But yeah, I mean, he wants to enjoy Ned, but he's not. Is how I read it.
Yeah.
I think what the way I would characterize at least how their relationship looks at in this scene is they maybe both feel some kind of duty or even just out of love, a desire to have a friendship of the highest sort, the unselfish one.
Okay, I'm going to read you a little passage from the book here.
But then the way it actually plays out is that Robert is utilizing him.
So. I think you're right. I think you're right on almost every front here. Okay. Martin writes, "No sooner had those formalities of greeting been completed than the king said to his host, 'Take me down to your crypt, Eddard. I would pay my respects.'" Mm-hmm. Ned loved him for that, for remembering her still after all these years. So I think that there is affection there. I think Ned loves him. The question is, what sort of love are we talking about?
Yeah.
And I think that Ned has this complicated relationship with Robert. I think he loves him for maybe the memory of the man he used to be.
Sure.
And I think Robert actually loves Ned because Ned makes him feel like a younger man. His very presence makes him feel better about, you know, what he once did and what he accomplished and what life was like when he was in his 20s.
Well, I think in both cases, I think you have a fondness that is very much sort of mm-hmm. rooted in the past.
Yeah.
I think Robert likes Ned because Ned reminds him of the old days, and mm-hmm. the old days were a lot better for Robert. And I think Ned likes Robert. Well, that's the one positive thing, I think, that Ned...
He loves Robert.
Said. Yeah, loves Robert. That's the one positive thing that Ned thinks or feels in the chapter about Robert is this very... after all these years kind of feeling.
Okay. So I think we're going to both agree that these two do not enjoy a friendship of mutual virtue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Ned, it's tricky. So it's definitely not mutual, right? Robert is utilizing him. I mean,
yes,
is not in Ned's best interest.
What Aristotle would say is that you don't graduate from one by discarding the previous. So you can build on these. You can become fast friends, you know, kindred spirits with your butcher.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that he doesn't sell you meat anymore or whatever. So I think you're right. I think that there is a heavy level of utility happening here. Robert really wants to use Ned politically, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He wants to use Sansa politically.
Right.
So there is certain utility and I wonder if that's always the case with a head of state. Like everyone, like even your friends, you have to look at politically at some point. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Being friends with someone in a role like that, kind of a public figure, it can be tricky because, you know, there's kind of duties that you feel to the public, like the well-being of this person who serves a large number of people, it affects all those people. And so your friendship with them is, in a way, becomes service to all those people that they serve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a weird, complicating factor in a friendship because, in a way, you'd like for a friendship to primarily, at least, involve the two individuals involved directly in the friendship. And to introduce these other factors, these external factors, can be a little, can kind of cloud the waters a little bit, I think.
In this particular relationship, there's this hierarchy of concerns. And one level of, maybe the highest level of concerns, are these political considerations, in that I think that Ned views it as his highest calling to do well by the people of the North.
Yeah.
And that extends beyond his family. He's kind of the father to the entire region.
Mm-hmm.
But he answers to a father figure at this point, and that is Robert, because Robert is father of the entire realm.
Yeah.
And the tension here is that Robert does not view the North as all that significant. He doesn't think it's that important.
Yeah.
He says, you know, he tells Ned, you're no good. You're no use to anyone here at the edge of the world. Everything that's really important that's happening in the realm is really happening in these other six kingdoms, and Ned's being wasted.
Sure. At one point, Robert says, where are all the people?
where are all your people? Sure. Yeah. You have this sense that Robert, the North is filled with snow and this weird wall. And
yeah, which Robert doesn't care about the wall, by the way. I mean, Ned brings it up and Ned's concerned about it, right?
Uh-huh.
And Robert sort of, who cares about the wall?
Yeah, it's stood for 8,000 years.
That's right.
All right. Yeah. So that's good. That's good. Okay. All right. So notable introductions and feel free to, I know that you've taken notes, so feel free to chime in if any of these grab you.
Yeah.
In this chapter, we're introduced to Sandor Clegane and his terrible burned face.
Yeah.
All right. I know that the Hound is a favorite of yours.
Yeah.
By the way, why is that? Why do you have affinity for
that's a good question.
Wounded and ruined creature.
I mean, I think my experience reading is this sort of, you know, unanalyzed, you know, I have a positive reaction to him, but I guess I like characters who cut through the crap, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's very much into cutting through the crap, and that's
he is a man of candor, if nothing else. Yeah,
that's right. And you know, there's a certain it's interesting, I guess. Characters who have great challenges are interesting, and here's a guy that has a lot of, well, he's gotten a raw deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's interesting to see him try to cope with the raw deal that he's gotten, and I think sometimes he makes choices that are admirable, even though it takes, no doubt, courage and strength.
Yeah, Martin really likes to do that. He likes to have a moment of virtue change your opinion about someone who looks like a creature of darkness, right?
Yeah. I think that the other thing about the character that's interesting to me is just sort of, you know, he's a horrible person.
He's a murderer. he's a killer, and he likes killing, right?
Yeah, so I noticed myself responding positively to him at certain points, and then like having to remind myself of the horrible things he's done. And that there's really no excuse for some of the things.
He brings a level of complexity that is a delight, I think.
I think in another way, he's just sort of he's a very roguish character, and I like roguish characters.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so we're introduced to Tyrion. We see the first glimpse of Tyrion Lannister, who's called the Imp. We're introduced to the snow-white cloaks of the Kingsguard. We hear of Balon Greyjoy's rebellion for the first time. We find out that Jaime and Cersei are twins. I think we knew that they were brother and sister before, but now we know that they're twins. We find out that before there were lords of Winterfell, there were kings of the North, long before the dragon lords came from across the sea. Howland Reed is mentioned, a little Crannog man.
Mm-hmm.
We hear the title, The Hand of the King, for the first time. We hear of Lord Tywin, and Ned says that he would sooner trust a pit viper than Lord Tywin.
Yeah.
So these are all like really crucial characters to the story. And all we get is a little glimpse of each of these.
He does a really good job of immediately giving the reader a sense of revulsion toward the Lannisters.
Yes, good. Yeah, absolutely. They're vipers. They look like they're made of gold, right? This is not necessarily a positive statement in the story. Since we're mostly introduced to Robert for the first time, I want to read you Robert's description.
Okay.
6.5 feet tall, he towered over lesser men. And when he donned his armor and the great antlered helmet of his house, he became a veritable giant. He had a giant strength, too. His weapon of choice was a spiked iron warhammer that Ned could scarcely lift. In those days, the smell of leather and blood had hung to him like perfume. Now, it was perfume that clung to him like perfume. The king had gained at least 8 stone. A beard as coarse and as black as iron wire covered his jaw to hide his double chin and the sag of the royal jowls. But nothing could hide his stomach or the dark circles under his eyes. I love that. All right.
Nothing could hide the stomach.
Yeah. Okay. This is a character whose best days are way behind him, right?
Right.
It's a great depiction of a man who was once a great warrior.
Yeah.
And has not fared well with wealth, I think.
Yeah, that's how he's introduced to us. And then through the rest of the chapter, especially if you know what's going to happen, which of course the first time you read it, you don't, but if you know what's going on, by the end of the chapter, reading it last night, I felt like, man, not only are his best days behind him and he's sort of physically in decline, but he's in this position where he's completely being played for a fool by absolutely every single person in his life, except maybe Ned.
Well, John Arryn probably tried to do right by him.
Yeah.
Which is probably why John Arryn had to die.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, he's sort of, he's a fool is how he comes off to me. He's a fool. And I think at a basic level, I don't even understand why he wanted to be king. I think he doesn't understand why he wanted to be king.
Huh. Yeah.
It never was a job that he would be suited for.
I think he wanted to be king because he wanted to win.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think Ned is much more, well, it's funny because I guess, I don't know where I get this, but over the years, I've definitely gotten the sense that George Martin does not really like Ned very much. And
What makes you think that?
I guess I don't have a specific memory of interviews with Martin where he talks about Ned in a negative way, but I have some vague memory that he sort of, you know, talks about Ned being, well, not a relatable character.
That's interesting. Okay.
And
Martin certainly likes rogues. He likes rogues and he likes very witty people. I wouldn't say that Ned is either of those things.
Right. Right. I think that sometimes Ned among the fans or commenters has gotten a reputation for being a bit naive. And I thought it's interesting that in this chapter, Ned comes off as a fairly wise person.
I think so. Early on in this book, he really does seem like the ideal father figure. You know, it's not like he's waxing on and reciting poetry or whatnot.
Yeah. Well, he didn't want to be king. He didn't want to be king's hand.
Right.
He doesn't want power.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. It's not this, what you described as Robert wanted to win, right? That's sort of a dumb idea. What do you want to win? What? To what end? Like what purpose? How is that going to change your life? How is that going to serve anyone?
Are you in the realm going to be happier for this victory?
Yeah.
Robert's not going to think ahead. Robert is not going to consider that question. He's just.
I want to be on the top. I want to stand on top of the mountain with my arms up.
Right.
I want to be the best and the strongest and the tallest. And I want to be the king. And what does that mean? I don't want to think about it.
that's for people that count coppers to think about.
That's right. Exactly. It's very foolish. And so as a result, he's surrounded by people. Every part of the story he tells about his own life is a deception. Even the things he believes about Lyanna. And, you know, he thinks that Rhaegar raped her. I guess, I don't know if this is known or if this is speculated, but I guess we believe that Rhaegar and Lyanna were in a consensual marriage together.
Well, that they were lovers. They were deeply and madly in love. That's the alternative story, right?
And I think people have speculated at least that they were actually married.
Okay, so that's good. So we're moving to book versus show differences. Yeah. If you've watched ahead in the shows, it is discovered that they were married in secret. Now, I don't know if that's going to actually find its way into the book.
Right.
But yeah. So in other words, the virtue of finding out that detail means that Jon Snow, who's really a Targaryen, was not born out of wedlock. And so he is the natural successor to the throne.
Right.
Okay. So there you go. In this chapter, I don't see many other book differences. The conversation is longer and more meandering. Mm-hmm. They have to introduce places like the Eyrie. There's some differences there. I don't know that the actor who plays Robert Baratheon is very well cast. I don't get the sense that particular actor was ever a great warrior who stood 6'6" and carried a war hammer.
That's so a tall order.
Yeah, it's true. But they found some really great actors for these other roles. Now, okay, so we're talking about book differences versus show differences, and I don't think that there are many to be had here, but this might be a good time to talk about your interesting relationship to Game of Thrones in general.
Well, I have not watched the show.
So you're one of the very few who's read these books.
Right.
And probably read a Game of Thrones multiple times, right?
Yeah, I've read all the books twice.
Okay.
I read them once years ago, around the time I think A Dance with Dragons came out. Yeah. Anyway, I read them all around that time. And then recently, anticipating that the next book in the series would be coming out, I read them again and probably finished my second read a year ago, thinking the book was on its way out.
Talk about foolish characters.
Yeah, no doubt.
That was a very foolish move.
Yeah. Yeah, now I'm going to have to read it a third time to be ready for the new book, right?
Okay, so why did you begin when you did, if the show wasn't the sort of your
Yeah, well, chief I'm motivation. Sure that the fact that the show began, it sort of made it a broader audience aware of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of that, I heard about it. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that I like. I mean, I like fantasy and science fiction, so.
I often hear that. I often hear people say I like fantasy and science fiction, but I don't think that it's... I think that they're saying more than what they mean. All right, yeah. So I'm going to test my theory out on you.
Okay.
My feeling is that people that say I like fantasy and science fiction like science fiction, but they like a few works of fantasy a lot, and maybe even more than any of their science fiction. But it's probably like a handful of fantasy books and a lot more science fiction. Is that true of you?
That's probably true. Yeah, that's probably true.
Because my feeling is that most fantasy is just unreadable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean,
you have to be really, really talented to create an entirely new world.
I agree with you.
And make it compelling and make the characters, you know, characters that you fall in love with. It really takes some sort of Tolkien or Martin-esque talent to do that sort of thing.
Yeah. I am very picky. And so, I mean, even when it comes to science fiction, I'm very picky. And I think what I would say is I like the idea of fantasy and the idea of science fiction much more than I like most of what actually is produced. And I don't necessarily think everybody should be that way. Maybe that's a defect on my part.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very picky. I want books to be top quality, and I won't even make my way through a book if it's not a great book. So I don't know. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of trash, but I do like both kinds of story. But yeah, I surely have read more science fiction than fantasy. I would say that's true.
All right, Chad.
Yes.
All right. A question that I did not prepare you for, so you can choose to answer this or not, because it may be too personal.
Okay.
If you think of all of the characters in all of these books in The Song of Ice and Fire, which character do you think your friends and family think you are? So who do they think you are? Mm-hmm. But deep down inside, who do you most feel like?
Yeah. Oh, geez. It's tough because honestly, you know, as I think through all of the characters, I sort of feel like to say of any other person that they are most like this or that character is a bit of an insult.
Yes, I'm asking you to insult yourself twice. Yeah.
They're all deeply flawed and in many ways I think there's not really an admirable character in the story.
I think you're wrong, but you can go ahead and
I mean it's
that.
Like it's,
a lot of
it's,
people say that.
Yeah, it's like I said before, it's sort of like there's a suspension of reservations about mm-hmm. the characters as you work your way through the story because you sort of, it's a story and you need to have empathy for the characters. And uh-huh. so you end up having empathy with, you know, the Hound or something. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, the guy is, you know, in the modern world for what he's done, he belongs in prison or the death penalty. Or
yeah,
something.
That's right.
And So, but who, if I,
this
if,
goes
if,
back to our conversation about wartime virtue, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are certain people who are very valuable in wartime that mm-hmm. should, that need, really do need to be in prison mm-hmm. during peacetime, you know, the Hound's yeah. one of those characters.
Yeah. So maybe, look, I mean, I'm a father and that's maybe my, one of my biggest roles in life. And so maybe that makes people think of Stark.
Sure.
Edward yeah. Stark. So
he's
so,
a very you know, admirable father.
Yeah. My children, my wife, perhaps they would say that about me. I don't know. I think the people that I most feel like.
Ned is a very cold person. He's a very cold personality, very stern, but he's not with his children. He's warm to his, and I think he's warm to his wife and children and probably a collection of close.
Yeah.
Close friends.
I think Ned can be inflexible. That's the reason he ends up dead.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't think it's naive so much as it is inflexible. He's got an idea how things should be and how he should proceed.
Well, I think to give, I tend to think that this whole stupid Ned trope is maybe overdone. It's kind of funny to call him a numpty head or whatever. I think you're probably right. He's inflexible. I also think that he's not so much stupid or naive as he just has a different set of priorities and he's not willing to compromise certain priorities in his life.
Yeah. I would say that I do relate to his inflexibility. I think I could be inflexible.
All right. Okay. So is this how people perceive you or how you perceive yourself?
Well, I think, you know, if you don't know me very well, you probably mostly have interacted with me in casual ways, and I'm extremely flexible when things are casual, but it's when things get difficult that I can become very difficult and uncompromising. I mean, everyone has
that little area where if you trespass on this particular area, you're yeah. going to find out that I actually do care about things, and I'm very right. particular about how this is supposed to go.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I'm usually very flexible, but when I care about something, like I care about my kids' education, right? I can be uh-huh. very, very inflexible uh-huh. and kind of difficult, you know? I mean, they might see me that way. Who do I think I am? I mean, this is difficult questions.
So you're like Ned bordering on Tywin.
Yeah, maybe.
This is not good so far.
I guess, you know, maybe I'll say I sort of aspire. How about this? I really do love Tyrion's wittiness and
yes.
his excellence when it comes to strategic matters. Those are things I value that I'd like to be good at. I like the Hound in the way that he is, as I said before, he sort of
yeah.
Sort
no, of no, 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 the crap. No, no, no. This is not. I'm not asking who your favorite character is. I'm asking you who
I am.
I'm asking you deep down inside. You know how that person ticks because there's a lot of that person deep down and inside you.
Yeah, I don't think I have an answer. Sorry.
That's a totally legitimate answer. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me, since you wimped out. So I think I'm going to try to answer your previous statement that there's really no wholly good characters.
Yeah.
And like everyone's a flawed character, right? I think measured by the standards of the modern world, Samwell Tarly is pretty much an altogether virtuous character.
Mm-hmm.
His fatal flaw in the story is that he's a coward.
Yeah.
But he overcomes it. He overcomes it. I mean, that's the problem that he's able to overcome to make his character arc work. So even that he overcomes. And mm-hmm. I don't see that he's a flawed character in the same way that I see that Danny or anyone like that is flawed in that way. And I think that I think it probably has to do with the fact that he's something of a Mary Sue for Martin. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think his cowardice, though he overcomes it, his cowardice is very unattractive.
Especially to his father, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's a significant flaw to me. You're saying that you could find a character that's free of significant flaws, and I'm not sure you've done that.
All right, Jon Snow. What about Jon Snow?
Jon Snow. Yeah, I guess he's probably the closest thing to a pure hero that we have in the story.
He does wrong by Ygritte, right? So yeah. he does wrong by her, but he does it in service to his sort of post as a spy.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that it's forgivable. It's just that the fact that fate or Martin has thrown him into a situation where he is being forced to lie, for the sake of the realm or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The story sort of beginning with the way Halfhand,
mm-hmm.
without really explicit instruction or permission, really sort of expects Snow to figure this treacherous, morally treacherous waters out. Right.
In fact, it begins with Corrin Halfhand telling John to kill him. He has to murder. I mean, talk about seal this in blood. This is a pact you're making with, you know, a man who's willing to sacrifice his life.
All right. So Jon Snow is the counterexample. He's pretty good.
All right. So that's interesting because he's certainly more courageous, right? He's sort of the model of courage.
Yeah.
But I still think Sam is better. Maybe that tells something about you and me. Anyway, if you were to come back on, which character would you want to talk about? Like all of these chapters are POV, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Would you want to do like a Hound POV, or would you want to do a Tyrion POV?
Yeah. I mean, I love the Hound. I'd love to talk about the Hound. That'd be great.
Does the Hound have a POV? I don't believe he does. Oh, geez.
He shows up a lot in the Arya chapters.
So we'd have to choose an Arya or Sansa, maybe Sansa chapter to talk about the Hound.
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. So one of your favorite characters, really, you don't hear their interior voice.
Yeah, I guess not.
Again, your dogged commitment to superficiality.
Hey, I have one other question for you.
All right.
So in this chapter that we've been talking about, at a certain point, Ned says that his sister was to have been the bride of Robert.
Yes.
Did Ned, at the time of this chapter, did Ned know that she had been consensually with Rhaegar?
I think so.
So it's funny that in his own mind, he's thinking of her still as having, I mean, he must have been aware that she intended not to marry Robert.
Well, here's another way to look at that. You could look at it as she was betrothed to Robert.
Yeah.
And yet she had taken a lover and maybe married secretly to Rhaegar.
Right.
So you could say, honestly, she was to be married to Robert. Simply because the betrothal was never broken, he's just only revealing half the story in that case.
Right. There's another little piece of text where it says, and this is, you know, Ned's thoughts to himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Robert vowed to kill Rhaegar for what he did to her.
Yeah.
It's funny that he would think of it that way if he didn't think Rhaegar really did anything to
him. Oh, interesting.
But I can't tell, is that sort of...
So you're suggesting that Ned maybe thinks that Lyanna was raped. And that she cares enough about the unborn child that she wants Ned to raise him in secret, even if it was out of an origin story of ill repute.
I wasn't sure. And in fact, I think it is sometimes difficult to interpret the narrator's voice in these point of view chapters. Is this really Ned's thought? Is this Martin kind of speaking, but from sort of in some sense from Ned's point of view?
Right. So, yeah, I guess the only way to answer this is to kind of look for these other clues throughout the books. And I'm sure that there are other people who have done that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I found myself uncertain what Ned believed about the circumstances surrounding Lyanna's death.
Right.
I also thought it was interesting that it said he sort of had a lapse in memory around that time. Which I guess, you know, the natural interpretation is that that had to do with his grief. But
so if Ned were to say because of what he thought he did to her, that would give up too much of the game. I think.
Yeah. Right.
If you were an author, if you qualified it in that way, that's too much to reveal at this stage of the narrative.
Right. But saying he vowed to kill Rhaegar for what he did to her, I mean, if that's really what Ned thought, then it seems like he thought Rhaegar did something to her. So it must have been very tricky to write, and maybe that's what we're seeing here. It's just that it was a tricky thing to write, and he had to make a decision there.
Yeah, and honestly, at this point, does Martin? This is chapter 4.
Yeah,
does Martin really have all this fleshed out in his mind? I mean, sometimes Martin has described himself as an author with the metaphor of being a gardener.
Yeah.
So he gardens here and he gardens there and see what grows out of these narratives. Maybe he's got this complicated relationship with Jon Snow being a bastard on the page.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know the outcome yet. It's possible that Martin doesn't know how this story is going to end at chapter 4.
Right, right.
It's kind of a non-answer, I suppose.
Yeah. Sounds like you wimped out.
Yeah, I did. I wimped out. All right, Chad, this has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And I appreciate you revisiting this chapter very closely. This was a ton of fun.
Thanks.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret, Hush Hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I have a relatively serious conversation about cripples, bastards, and broken things, punctuated by the first of many conversations about Roderick Castle's sideburns. Steve, you just recently watched episode 4, Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things. Which would you say you are?
Ooh, yeah. Ooh. I mean, I feel like the easy answer is the broken thing, because as far as I know, my birth certificate lines up. But, I mean, I'm not in the best shape.
You can be a bastard at times. I've known you long enough to see okay. you be a bastard.
Okay, so not necessarily in the, so more in the colloquial sense.
Yeah, I wouldn't know otherwise. This episode seems to have a little bit of a theme related to compassion.
Yeah.
I would say Samuel Tarly, he's the portly fellow that makes it up north.
Right.
I'm not sure what he is, but he's a creature in need of compassion.
Right. Yeah. And so that's, and it's an interesting turn in the show, and to have a very specific spotlight on a notion of compassion, because you don't really feel like, because everything is, there's so much order. Mm-hmm. Compassion doesn't seem to fall into the world of order. So it's kind of a jarring episode in that regard.
You have John trying to show some compassion to Sam, mm-hmm. who's a coward. He even says he's a coward.
He's the coward of the county. R.I.P. Kenny Rogers.
R.I.P. Kenny Rogers, the coward. That's a very underrated Kenny Rogers song.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if sure. The Gambler might as well be the national anthem. So, I mean, fine. I mean, I'm not going to discount it. I'm not going to say The Gambler is overrated. It is properly rated. It's a work of musical art. But Coward of the County has, I mean, it's graphic.
Well, Coward of the County is interesting in that it's very dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely dark, but it's a little bit peppy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's peppy dark, and that's, I think, that's what country music does so fine.
That's how you know someone's really in trouble. when the suicidal ideation is accompanied by a very peppy tune.
Listen to it again, because it does end with a slight ominous. It feels like a short story. Like he goes through the whole thing, and you figure, like, okay, well, he's come full circle, right? So maybe he's not the coward of the county. And then he just ends with, they call him the coward of the county. And it just sort of like, did he not conquer it?
No, he didn't. This is a cycle. This is a,
yeah.
If you have a little peppy tune to it, it means that you experience it in good times and in bad.
Right.
So this is him sort of managing his own cowardice.
Sure.
And I think Samuel Tarly he's tried to manage his own cowardice, but somehow it hasn't worked out so well.
Well, and then that's a fascinating character. I mean, you get his backstory, and this is the choice he took, but he also doesn't feel like, it feels like he just is prolonging the inevitable. I mean, he couldn't have anticipated getting compassion going into this situation.
All right. This episode ends with taking Tyrion under arrest.
Yeah. The scene is great. It's a great juxtaposition to the earlier scene where he's being, you know, compassionate and he's making his offer, so to speak, because there's a certain similarity in terms of how it's filmed and where he's positioned.
Oh, you're saying that when he first enters Winterfell, he's in the center of the Great Keep.
Once again, holding all the attention, but this time he's managing the conversation, right? I mean, even when they're trying to be disrespectful, he still has the social gravitas to take this situation into his own. Now, it's interesting how, like, and he makes them come to his level, right?
Yeah,
so that he can have, so he doesn't have to look up, right? But so then we see him later. Now we have a situation where everybody rises and is pointing swords downward to him. I really like that book ending.
Well, I think that Tyrion is used to being the center of attention wherever he goes. He attracts a lot of attention for a variety of reasons, not all good. He's sort of learned to use that to his advantage.
Well, and I think that there's, I mean, if you look at the title of the episode, do you think Lady Stark has that same type of boldness? Should it be somebody who's not Tyrion? Not an imp in that regard. Would she have confidence and, you know, and would everybody else respond?
So, all right, two things. One is, yes, I think Catelyn is bold. I think she's just like her father.
Too bold.
Too bold, that's right. And I think that she probably would have tried to capture anyone of any stature. I think that she probably brings more people to her support because Tyrion doesn't seem like he poses much of a threat.
Right. Okay. So that's fair.
Second thing, The title is interesting to me because you have these notable acts of compassion that we've already talked about. But then we have, I think, false compassion. Like, for instance, when Littlefinger sidles up to Sansa and tries to scare her with the story of the burn-faced hound, right?
Oh, by the way, just a little, I mean, we've all seen that guy at the bar, right?
So, yeah, so I think that this is clearly someone who's preying on someone who is less fortunate or weaker than himself.
And if you look at the acts of compassion, the acts of compassion are primarily from the broken things to broken things, right?
Uh-huh. I mean,
that's an important aspect of where the compassion is flowing from. And then we've already seen where Littlefinger has already said, you know, you're wise to distrust me. There's already this element of you can't trust anyone. And embedded in that is that sense of politicking, the sense of rank, all of that goes into it. But it's like when you sort of wipe that away, you tend to find maybe more pockets of compassion. And the question then, of course, is that compassion, is it fleeting? If one of these broken things finds themselves in a better situation, will they continue to have that? Will survival trump compassion? All of those things.
Yeah, I think that we all have limits to our compassion, some of us more than others. And I think that to show compassion is in itself dealing from a position of power.
Fair.
But yeah. I would like to talk about, if you don't mind, this is something I've been waiting to discuss with you. Sir Roderick Castle is Lady Stark's traveling companion.
Right.
And I'd like to talk about his sideburns.
Yeah, I think this is important.
When your sideburns get that long, are they sideburns anymore? Should we call them? I mean, is this just a different sort of beard now?
Or are they face burns?
They're face burns or neck burns?
Yeah, and so his sideburns, and then sideburns can become mutton chops can become beard, but I don't feel like his is just sideburns.
See, I think that in the modern world, the mutton chop really is the pinnacle of the sideburn. And if you can get a mutton chop that's just really poofy, that like really gives your face volume, that's as much that is socially acceptable.
Right.
And, you know, that'd probably work better if you were sort of a, you know, 1970s guitarist or something. Roderick Castle has taken this to a whole new level.
It's almost a neckerchief.
It probably keeps his neck warm.
A neckerchief fashioned from one's own sideburns. Now that to me that's being resourceful, right?
It really is. If there was a pandemic, he could use it as a face mask.
That's true. That's very true. It definitely shows, I mean, I'm sure it can be a sexual thing too, but I mean, it definitely shows.
Oh, I never thought about that.
Well, think about it. It'll change you a little bit.
Wait, give me a second here.
yeah. Picture handlebars.
Oh my.
Yeah. He's got to go. There's an effort, right? And I mean, I don't know exactly where he fits in, you know, class status. So I don't know if he shaves his own face, but he either has to go through with every day going, yeah, I'm still going to do this look, or he has to ask somebody, like, you know, just a little off the underneath.
Well, here, let me give you a little context here. So he's the master of arms, which means he trains all of these Stark men in swordplay.
Okay.
So this guy, he's kind of a badass. And I don't know if these neckerchief burns help him fight.
Yeah.
But they must have some purpose.
It feels like, can you like, maybe he puts his keys on it?
Let's say you came in really close. And you could just grab those things. And I can just imagine that really, really hurting.
Yeah.
Unless he's just that good. He's like, hey, I dare you. I dare you to
taunt. Yeah, he's just hanging it out there. Like when you're playing with a cat and you've got like a stick and a little string at the end. He's just like, no, come get it. It seems like a weakness, doesn't it? He's like Marshawn Lynch out there with his dreads. No, grab him. Go ahead. See what happens.
He could hang little bells off the end.
Again, it's sort of a sexual thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Give me another second here. Oh.
Well, it does feel a little professional wrestlerish. He's like the ravishing Rick Rude of the battlefield.
I think we've certainly come to a central truth of Game of Thrones here. Roderick Castle is the ravishing Rick Rude of Westeros.
I'm interested. Yeah. Now, see, now that makes a lot more sense. Now I'm like, oh, okay, now I get it.
If you're below 40 years of age, do do a YouTube search for Ravishing Rick Rude. He's a real guy. This really happened. Hopefully it will never happen again.
What I love about Ravishing Rick Rude is he could have been very popular if he was Rick Rude. He could have been very popular if he was Ravishing Rick. He tripled down.
Just the name Rick. Can we just say that? Just the name Rick tells you everything you need to know.
A wrestler named Rick. That sounds like a really good Shel Silverstein poem.
All right. There was a mention of a pirate in this episode. How do you feel about pirates?
I'll be honest. Hearing the pirate thing, I'm like, I don't think I'm ready to add pirates.
No?
I feel
pirates are always interesting to me because they're really bad people, and yet we're pretty happy with our children dressing up as them.
As a parent, I've never been able to get my hands on. They're like, look, he's like a cute little pirate. I'm like, well, which part is the cute?
Well, I think that a lot can be made up if you have a talking bird. Like, you could be a moral monster, but if you have a talking bird that just perches on your shoulder.
Yeah, I think it's a combination, right? I don't think it's enough to be talking. I think it's got a little side-to-side head bob that they can do.
Yeah, that's
my favorite
dance.
Part. My favorite part of parrots. Talking's parrots, fine.
Parrots and pirates.
Yeah, exactly. The thing about parrots is like, yeah, they can talk, but they're just kind of repeating sounds. It's that little dance that they do, that little head move. Good Lord, that is intoxicating. I think I'm just taken by dancing animals.
What if it's Sarah Palin on The Masked Singer? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, sort of the same concept.
There's always limits to compassion.
See what that's I mean? I think, and that it seems like a real good summation, right? You can have
that is a case in point.
You can have compassion down, but you can't have compassion up.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. That is both true and pithy.
There we go.
So you're at episode 4 now. Are you whole hog in? How are you feeling about the first season as a whole?
I think I'm pretty close to whole hog in. Episode 3 was the one that really hooked me. So I think that there were some elements of this particular episode that I wasn't as hooked, but episode 3 did its work to keep me being like, okay, all right, I know what I want out of this so far. So I'll sit through some themes and tropes that I might not necessarily be all that jazzy about, but I'll give it the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. You know, I used the phrase whole hog in just now for the first time.
Okay.
I've never used that phrase. I've never heard that phrase. Whole hog in. I just feel really dirty about the whole thing.
Yeah. Is that even how the phrase goes?
No, it's not. But now that I've said it that way,
yeah,
I feel like I need to apologize to you and everyone who's listening.
I just want to know where that hog is going.
No, no, you don't.
I mean, it's all of it.
I mean,
Have
you seen a hog?
That's not a mean feat.
All right. I think we're good. Jeez.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now for this week's Bird's Eye View.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to talk to you about one of my favorite topics, and that's love. That's right. My favorite kind of love is the love expressed between ancient suzerain and vassal agreements in legal contractual language. So there are these ancient political arrangements between more powerful kings and less powerful kings. The more powerful king, let's call him the pharaoh, would be the suzerain. Now, this is medieval language that we're applying to the ancient world, but I hope that you'll indulge me. The lesser king, we might call this king the lord, again, anachronistic language, would be called the vassal. And so you've got these asymmetrical political relationships between greater kings and lesser kings. And in these contracts between these kings, we have lots of love language, lots of expressions of love, and this is official political language. So it may seem odd to us that expressions of love would find their way into these legal documents because we think of love differently. We think of love less politically than our forebears. I bring this up because Ned and Robert, in my opinion, clearly love each other, but not in a way that we easily recognize in the modern world. Here's an example. In one letter from the 14th century BC, modern-day Lebanese coast, a king pleads for military enforcements from the Egyptian pharaoh. And in this case, the pharaoh is the more powerful king in this contractual relationship. And the Canaanite king recalls their treaty and uses the phrase, and I'm quoting here directly, "If I die, who will love you?" Besides being absurdly passive-aggressive, the point here is that the regional leader is contractually devoted to the pharaoh. So while the word is best translated as love, it carries the meaning of devotion, loyalty, obedience, service, etc. Not in the same way we use love. This is a very politically oriented love. Now, for the lesser party in these arrangements, demonstrating love for the king looks one way, and then the king's demonstration for the love of the lesser party looks a bit different. Simply put, the love in this contract is asymmetrical. Modern analogy, think of the relationship between Oprah and Stedman. Stedman is clearly the lesser vassal in this relationship. So contracts between vassals and their more powerful counterparts could cover matters of military alliances, expressions of worship. If you were disloyal, there'd be consequences. Agreements for open channels of communication, like if I'm going to send you an envoy or a messenger, you have to let them in the border. You can't keep them waiting at the border, that sort of thing. Regular diplomatic gift exchanges, and marriage arrangements, etc., etc. All right, so that's ancient Near East. And we know that Martin likes to play with hybrids between ancient, modern, and medieval. But let's talk about specifically a medieval example of what we're talking about here. So we'll skip in both time and place to the medieval Frankish Empire. This relationship between the kings and the lords was largely driven by economics. But it would be difficult to overstate the importance of warfare for this suzerain-vassal relationship. Many regions were simply not self-sufficient, economically speaking. And so these lords depended on regular battles whereby they would get richer by way of wartime spoils. Simply put, the political relationship was fortified by going to war together and getting wealthier together. Sometimes the lesser vassals would push the Merovingian king into battle even when there was a peace offer at the table. So with Ned and Robert, we see a relationship built on childhood friendship, but it's been politicized at least twice in battle. First, the North, Ned especially, was integral to winning Robert's rebellion. And secondly, Ned backed Robert in putting down the Greyjoy Rebellion. In this way, Ned has expressed his love for his king. And then in peacetime, their relationship changes dramatically. In other words, they express their love less often for each other in peacetime. And this teaches us something important about suzerains and vassals. And this is true for both Martin's world and our own past. So here it is. Political contracts are made in large part because of war, or the possibility of war. My sense is that Robert feels another war on the horizon. His choice for Ned as Hand of the King is indeed because he loves him. And this, I think, does include his childhood affection for Ned. But it's also a different sort of love. It's the sort of love that commands his loyalty and his service and his obedience. It's the sort of love that a king can command of a vassal. And that's all for this week.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Next time on Electric Boogaloo.
This episode had a lot of action.
It did. It had quite a bit of action.
And it was almost
a little bit more breastfeeding than I probably would have enjoyed.